Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. We've talked about before the backlog of untested rape kits in our state. It's up to 10,000 that sit untested. The rapists still out there. The numbers are even higher for across the country. But even having access to that rape kit can be a major challenge as well for someone who's just been sexually assaulted. They don't know where to go. Even if they do make it to a hospital, there is no guarantee. But a bill introduced in Congress this week by two lawmakers from our state aims to change that. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has the details on that.
Colleen, it's known as SASCA, or the Survivors Access to Supportive Care Act. And it's been a passion for Democratic Senator Patty Murray since she found out about the lack of access to sexual assault examiners or SANE nurses in hospitals across our country and in our state. Murray first learned about the problem when she heard from Leah Griffin, who was raped in Seattle in 2014.
When I came to, I was disoriented and bleeding. I drove to the closest emergency room. I told them what had happened. They shrugged their shoulders and said, "We don't do rape kits here." I had the option at that point to either drive myself across the city or take an ambulance at my own expense. Neither of those options were realistic at the time, so I submitted to a medical exam and I went home.
Eventually, Leah made her way to that other hospital, which was Harborview, where she could have her rape kit done.
At the time, it was the only hospital in my county that provided rape kits and had a rape kit done. But that delay in care and the contamination of the crime scene, my body, contributed to prosecutors' decision to decline charges in my case.
So you might think that that happened in a smaller town or a rural area. It's
devastating.
Crazy. It's absolutely
devastating that because she didn't have access to a rape kit, her rapist is not going to pay for the crime. Wow. So what's going to happen?
From there, and again, you might have thought that that was in a smaller rural area or a small town. That was in Seattle.
It was Seattle.
And that was 4 years ago. But Leah says her situation is not unique.
Out of 1,000 rapes, only 6 result in a prison sentence. We have a justice system that demands empirical evidence to prosecute rape, but then denies victims access to that evidence collection and due process. There are rape victims all over the country being turned away from hospitals or driving hundreds of miles for care.
Frustrated, Leah turned to Senator Patty Murray, who had a government accountability report done back in 2015 and found massive gaps in sexual assault care services all over the country. The two have been working together since then to get this bill done.
It is absolutely unacceptable that someone would go to seek care and justice for sexual assault and be told, "Not here," or "Try next door." The Survivors Access to Supportive Care Act will help us make sure that it no longer happens to survivors across the country who are seeking help. Our legislation takes important steps to make sure we treat sexual assault examinations as a health care priority, not an afterthought or an inconvenience.
Now, one of the big issues here is that there isn't even anyone tracking where and which hospitals across the country actually have sexual assault examiners. The best estimate from the International Association of Forensic Nurses is that only between 14 and 17% of major hospitals in the U.S. have them.
That's it.
That's it.
So this isn't just a regional issue. This is
no.
This is countrywide.
Yes. So part of what this bill in Congress, again, will do is get a state-by-state survey. So there's a starting point to figure out exactly which hospitals have them, where the needs are. If we're talking about rural areas, does it need to be a nurse's place at a regional facility of some sort?
So if you Googled, just say, for instance, which, I mean, this is a ludicrous scenario because when something as traumatic as this happens to you, you're not reaching for your phone Googling. Where do I get a rape kit? But say you did. Say you thought, "I don't know where to go. We Google everything these days." Would Harborview come up?
I have not Googled that. I know that you could for sure call and give and ask that
still
question.
Even but that, yeah, I mean, the arduous process of calling around when you just need help from a medical professional. That, okay.
It's amazing. And as you kind of heard from Leah's story there, she was in a state of shock. She was in no shape to be having to make those kind of decisions.
Anybody who's been through a traumatic incident knows you're not thinking clearly, nor should you have to in these moments. So she should just be able to go seek medical care.
And up until I heard her story and this these efforts, which I've been following for some time, I was amazed. I would have always assumed that if that happened to me and I went to whatever hospital was closest, that I would have the ability to have a rape kit done.
Well, that's what you see in movies.
Right?
That's
exactly what I said to her.
They're always ready with the swab.
Mm-hmm. And it's just not the case. Yeah. So this bill would help to do that. It also includes training for more sane nurses, continuing education of those nurses so they don't burn out, and increasing access to rape kits at hospitals all across the country. Now, this bill was introduced in the last Congress, and it didn't get far. But it's different this time. Senator Murray and Leah have worked very hard on this. And this time around, there's a companion bill that was introduced in the House by Washington Democratic Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, who says this is legislation that is vital for victims of sexual assault.
A large majority go, as Leah did, to a U.S. emergency room that does not have the capability to respond, does not have sexual assault nurse examiners to collect evidence, which is absolutely crucial for completing the rape kits in the most non-invasive way and for helping survivors like Leah take those next steps forward for healing and for justice.
So here is the other big difference this time around. This bill not only got introduced in both chambers this time, it did so with bipartisan support. It's got a Republican co-sponsor for the legislation in the Senate and in the House, which is a huge deal. So it's for the legislative folks like speak like me, it's bipartisan and bicameral support, which really gives Leah a lot of hope.
I am so excited and I feel extremely encouraged. And I'm so happy that we're going to pass this and other survivors aren't going to have to go through what I went through, and that they'll be able to get access to care when they present at the hospital.
One of the key parts in this, and Senator Murray's office told me this when I talked to them yesterday when I got the early announcement about this being introduced, and then again today, this doesn't happen without Leah's advocacy. Remember, she went almost immediately after going through this, not having this kit, finding out the outcome of her case. She went and reached out as a constituent to Senator Patty Murray's office. They've worked together. She's advocated this for four years now. And that's what Senator Murray's office told me made all the difference in this.
Just out of curiosity, I did Google, where do I get a rape kit test in Seattle? The hospital did not come up.
It did not come.
So it's not an easy answer. And so I'm so happy that they can get this done. Why was it that last session it didn't go very far? Was there just too much else going on? Or
it could be anything. This was back in 2016, so this was the last Congress. And again, it didn't have that Republican support. It didn't have bipartisan support, and it wasn't even in both chambers. So it's a big deal to have that, again, introduced in the House, introduced in the Senate, and with Republican co-sponsors on both sides. I think some people didn't know about it. I'm sure it was 2016. There was a lot going on.
Well, when we found out about the untested rape kits, I mean, that was a surprise to many people. So I suppose this is just the long process of changing injustice.
Yes. And I want to point out, Leah is a huge advocate in our state as well for that rape kit test backlog. She is on the legislative task force in our state legislature. She fights for victims of sexual assault, and she's fighting for the rape kit test backlog to get undone, and we can expect some great things from her, I think, moving forward.
Can't wait to hear the outcome. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Imagine this. You've just bought the home of your dreams, and all that's left to do is wire the down payment, and you wire the down payment, and you're waiting to close, and your agent says, did you wire the down payment? You say, yes, I did. Well, we didn't get it.
Oh, nightmare.
And this is what's been happening. Nathan Wilson covers this story for Cairo 7. Tell us what's going on, Nathan.
It's a scam that's been going around for probably a couple of years, but it's really picked up recently because there are so many hot real estate markets. Home prices keep climbing. There's so much competition for homes that people are anxious to get that home when they find the home that they want. So what happens is someone's email gets compromised. It's going to be the realtor, the broker, somewhere along the line, someone's email is going to get accessed. And that's how someone will find their potential victim. And then they'll create an email that looks almost identical to the person who they're spoofing. You know, it uses a picture from maybe the company's website and has all the right logos, all the right language, and it says, hey, you know, we have to change the wire instructions the last minute. Click on this link immediately. If you don't do this now, you're going to lose the home. And of course, they want to get that home, and so they don't think to call or double check. They click on the link and they wire hundreds of thousands of dollars. and that money starts disappearing quickly.
Oh, that's really too bad. And, you know, I noticed when we bought our home a couple of years ago, a lot of it was done electronically over email. The thing I appreciated, though, is that the broker or whoever it was would always call us and follow up and make sure that we were following the steps. Did you speak to brokers and mortgage lenders and ask if this has been around for 2 years, how are they not protecting themselves better against this?
I think more and more the warnings are going out. The realtors and the broker that I talked to, they said, we started hearing about this, you know, a while ago, but now they really are getting better systems in place to where they will either not do anything over email, or they'll say, if you don't get it from this exact email or from this exact phone number,
right,
ignore it, or we won't do anything over email, period. So I think a lot of the companies are now finally starting to catch on. The problem is the scammers know that they're catching on, and so they're getting even more sneaky with how they do it. And sometimes it's just a matter of looking at the email address. It'll look exactly like the correct email address with one slight variation. And if you don't catch that variation, that's when you're going to start sending the money to the scammer.
And put some numbers on this for us, because buying a home is stressful enough, Nathan. Now I don't want people out there thinking, is my money going to the wrong place? So what do we know about how prevalent it is in our state?
In our state, these kinds of scams cost people $16 million. Now, that number is not just the real estate market, because while the real estate market is kind of the newest target for this scam, it actually targets any kind of company or any kind of business that deals with wiring instructions. You know, there's another company that's local where someone spoofed the CEO's email, emailed someone within the company, said, you need to wire this money immediately for this deal. They did it. The company lost $300,000.
Has anybody been caught?
It's so rare for someone to get caught. It all depends on law enforcement getting help overseas. A lot of this money was going to Hong Kong, but authorities there started working more with the FBI here, and they were able to slow that down. So now the money's going elsewhere. There was actually just arrests last week about a group of 8 people who were caught in Africa who had targeted a Memphis real estate company and stole $15 million using this scam. But they were caught. It's rare, but it can happen if the authorities in foreign countries cooperate with authorities here.
This seems completely unnecessary. When we have physical checks, you could write on the back of the check for deposit only, so that nobody could take it and just cash it, right? Now we have electronic transactions. Why can't it be embedded in the transaction saying for domestic transfer only, right? The idea that somehow you can hide a foreign transfer address in a transaction like this, and the banks would obey it, just floors me. Because if you could limit it, and this would be easy. I mean, every transaction for a home in this area is going to be a domestic transaction. You're not going to be wiring the money overseas. Why can't that be embedded as part of the orders that you place when you wire the money?
I think part of the issue is that when the money goes through the bank, let's say you wire the instructions and it comes out of your bank, mm-hmm. it's going to another domestic bank. So your bank is not going to see anything different about it. It's just going to be like, oh, they're transferring money to another U.S. bank.
Mm-hmm.
No red flag. Then the next bank just sees it as a normal wire instruction from that bank to a foreign bank. The victims are not their customer. So to them, it just looks like a normal wire transfer with no red flags. And so that's why it's so important that banks are now paying more closer attention, looking for any kind of red flag, the large amount of money, foreign country. Maybe this is something that we should flag.
Well, seems like a bad system to me. You can find out all about it tonight on Cairo 7. Nathan Wilson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A little more about that House hearing that devolved into a shouting match yesterday.
This investigation is a joke. It's a fraud.
He knows, we know he's lying, and he could probably pass a polygraph.
Members of Congress are trying to question FBI agent Peter Strzok about the investigation of the 2016 election, which Strzok was working on, until he was removed after some of his provocative text messages came out. Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan watched the hearing, and I asked her if this is pretty much a reflection of how both parties in Congress feel about each other these days.
When it comes to this ongoing investigation into President Trump and any kind of chance to score political points around it, the answer is yes. It's not clear what was actually learned in that hearing. It seems that both sides came in with their opinions and left with those opinions unchanged. Of course, the person who was in the hot seat, Peter Strzok, this FBI agent, was being given the opportunity in a public forum to defend himself. He's obviously been publicly criticized by the president, accused of being biased in any of the work that he was doing on the probe at the time when he was working with the Mueller investigation. He's no longer working with the Mueller investigation. But all of this controversy goes back to some text messages that do look pretty bad for him in that he was denigrating then-candidate Donald Trump during the campaign. And the question of whether the perception of political bias, what looked like some nasty text, actually amounted to influencing his work on the job. And it's not clear that it did at all.
In the aftermath of this, where does the Congress go? I mean, they apparently do not agree on anything at this point. When we finally get this Mueller report, do you think Americans will believe it?
Well, I think that is the question that matters, because what all of this adds up to is perhaps a very keen political strategy to defang whatever the results are of that probe. If the public loses confidence in the investigation itself, perhaps they won't believe the outcome of that investigation. Remember, this was a political calculus similar to during the Clinton administration when Bill Clinton faced the impeachment vote. The strategy was to have this be a vote on strictly partisan lines, not on the actual facts of the matter, because that's safer territory for the president. And that is the same strategy that the president's lawyers and the president's team of defenders seem to be launching here. And it would seem that some of his allies in Congress agree with that. It's not clear, though, where to put Trey Gowdy. He has, in his role as House Oversight Chairman, said he really wants to uphold the integrity of the Mueller probe. He has repeatedly said that the work that the FBI is doing on that is not only called for and justified, but a service to this nation. In this public hearing yesterday, though, he really did take issue with this one particular agent, Peter Strzok, yeah, and his behavior. So we want to parse that with Trey Gowdy to say what exactly is the message to the American public and what exactly was learned by this use of taxpayer dollars.
Right. He and others, though, also said, how do we know? How can we trust the FBI? How do we know there aren't more Peter Strzoks or people who harbor the same opinions still working in the FBI or on this investigation? Because you know, they're not going around texting their inner thoughts. And I guess that what concerns me is what one of the members of Congress brought out, that if you tear down an institution like the FBI, which I think has a lot of credibility, who investigates stuff? I mean, who rides herd on the conduct of not just people suspected of collaborating with the Russians, but ordinary, everyday criminals.
Right. And that's the political cost that Peter Strzok said, that the ultimate cost to the country that may result from this, if you view how he's being questioned as a broader sort of demonization of the FBI. Others would say, no, you're responsible for your own behavior, and these were words you wrote. You need to answer for them. So some of that comes down to your own filter. But when it comes to this broader idea of challenging those who are professionals, who, while they may have their own personal opinions, whether they're a judge, whether they're an agent at the FBI or another institution, that they can put those opinions aside and work on facts. Journalists should be doing the same, right? This questioning of whether that is in any way possible anymore in this environment is something we constantly see being dragged into the public arena and debated these days. But as Strzok said yesterday, he was answering questions under oath. He took that oath seriously, and he argues that there was no political bias in terms of the work he did, though he was making clear he disagreed with some of the things that Donald Trump as a candidate said. And to be very fair, if you look at a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill, many of them were also saying publicly at the time and privately they didn't agree with some of the things that candidate Trump was saying at the time. Does that mean now that they are, you know, not qualified to be weighing in on anything the president does?
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. And Here he is, Cairo film critic Tom Tangney with one of the breakout hits from the Seattle International Film Festival, now in theaters nationwide. Sorry to Bother You. This has a pretty interesting premise.
It does indeed, and I got a chance to interview the director when he was here for the film festival, and so we're going to kind of focus on that aspect. His name is Boots Riley. I don't know if you've heard of him, Dave, but he's a longtime rapper, and this is his first time directing a movie. And his basic overall approach to filming is art is not enough, and neither is straight entertainment, nor is commercial success, and yet his film, Sorry to Bother You, just might be all three. And that's what's interesting about his approach to movies. Now, as you mentioned, Sorry to Bother You was a breakout hit both at Sundance and at the International Film Festival here in Seattle. It opened last week in limited release. It's already earned rave reviews and a great per-screen average box office for an indie film, mind you. And it opens nationwide today, including here in Seattle. Now, Riley stopped by Cairo Radio to talk to me about his funny, outrageous, and politically charged comedy. And after first establishing that he does indeed want to bother people with Sorry to Bother You, Riley says his disdain for telemarketing inspired the premise of the film.
For the person doing it, it can be soul-killing. You know, I've done telemarketing, and while I was doing it, I was like, okay, I'm going to have my revenge on this industry. So this is it.
So Riley says telemarketing, even when it's for a good cause, tends to corrupt you. And he admitted to me in the interview, there's some ethically questionable fundraising techniques. Again, even when it's for a good cause.
I was based in Berkeley, but we were raising money for the LA Mission, which is a homeless shelter in downtown Los Angeles.
Okay.
But we were calling to Orange County to raise money, which is a very conservative area. And so my pitch was like, hello, we're taking a poll to see how you're doing with the rash of break-ins in your neighborhood. They'd be like, what? I didn't know about that. Well, okay, that's good that it hasn't touched you yet. Maybe our plan is working, because what we're doing is, we know the police aren't going to solve this. What we want to do is get all the homeless people out of your neighborhood. Bring them to downtown Los Angeles.
I gotcha.
And that is genius.
It is genius, but it's ethically questionable.
He actually did this.
He did this, yes. So he knows. Yeah. It's a bit like, Glengarry Glen Ross. David Mamet actually did that kind of cold calling business and then wrote a play about it, and that's what this movie's about. So in the movie, Sorry to Bother You, a young black man named Cassius Green is hired to make cold call pitches for a mysterious business called Worry-Free Living Solutions. Riley explains what that's about.
There is this company that offers lifetime guaranteed employment and housing. It's kind of part of making a statement on the new companies that exist that basically their slogan is, for all intents and purposes, the new capitalism is no capitalism. What? This isn't a company. This is a beanbag sitting place. You know, we're just hanging out. I'm not your boss.
Fair enough.
I'm just the guy that tells you what to do.
So, in the movie, Green is having no success with his pitches until an older African-American employee, played by Danny Glover, by the way, pulls him aside and teaches him to adopt a white voice in order to win people over. And sure enough, as soon as he masters that voice, he rises up the ladder of success. Now, Riley has a lot more up his sleeve than just a clever satire on how minorities have to navigate a white man's world. He's even more interested in class issues, union activities, corporate power structures, and the very foundations of capitalism itself. But despite these rather heavy-duty concerns, a lot of the film is a breezy and accessible comedy, refreshingly imaginative and entirely unpredictable. And when it seemingly goes off the rails and it enters some truly bizarro territory, I have to warn people, Riley is clear enough with his wacky metaphors for all of it to mostly make sense. Intriguingly, Riley insists that the success of Sorry to Bother You should be judged not on its artistic merit, nor on its commercial appeal, but on its ability to effect change. Simply put, art is not enough.
Does art by itself do anything? No, it doesn't. What only way it does something is if it inspires people to organize themselves, affecting material change, but just exposing the way the world is not enough.
In other words, if Sorry to Bother You does not move audiences to change the world, he will count it something of a failure. Now, that may seem an impossibly high bar to clear, and it is, but Riley is deadly serious. He's at heart a revolutionary, and art is his medium.
Can he talk white?
Can he talk? Oh, you bet he can. He says, yeah, everybody does, although he says, one of the jokes of the movie is, yeah, do blacks have to talk white? But he says, but whites have to talk white. That it's not a real voice. It's like we all have, my wife calls it my company voice. You can tell when I'm on the phone that I'm very, you know, polite. You can tell it's not my brother I'm talking to. And we all have to adopt that to approach living and dealing with people. And a lot of that is hypocrisy. And he punctures that balloon again and again and again.
So how many tangs for sorry to bother you?
So I give it 3 because it wasn't quite what I was expecting. But my hunch is on a second time, third time round, there's so much in there. It might be a 3.5, Dave. But right now I'll give it a 3 out of 4. Good.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
Tom Tangney, part of the Tom and Curly Show. Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. The Angels. So the Angels are going to be our big competition in the pennant race?
No. It's the A's. The A's are nipping at our heels, Dave. You see them back there, pesky little Oakland.
Oh, Oakland, not the Angels.
The Angels drubbed the Mariners last night.
You like to have two teams that begin with A?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The Angels are 2 games above 500. The A's are the hottest team in baseball. And
what makes them so hot?
Well, they're a well-put-together team. They got some... The A's always find a way to be competitive. The A's are the most efficient team in baseball. They do the most with the least. Now, they haven't won a World Series with that approach in the past 20 years, but they're really... They find a way, and they've got a lot of good young talent on that team. Chris Davis is a big slugger. The third baseman they have, Chapman, is fantastic. They just finished beating the Astros 3 or 4 times.
I see that.
And that was the opportunity for the Mariners last night. If they could have won the game and won the series against the Angels, they would have been 2 games back. But now you start to feel Oakland's breath kind of beaten down. I think that A's are 5 games back of the Mariners and 8 games back of the Astros.
Do we have some injuries last
Paxton
night?
Paxton hurt his back. Okay. Now, this is, I don't want to celebrate a back injury. Everybody's had a back injury. It stinks. Mm-hmm. But when I found out it was Paxton's back, I was greatly relieved.
Because?
He faced 5 hitters. He gave up 2 home runs and 3 runs. It looked bad, and I thought it was his arm. And that's terrible news if it's your arm, because there's no such thing as a minor arm injury to a pitcher. Like, if it's something with his arm going wrong, that's bad. And he left the
game.
But
his arm is connected to his back.
Well, it was just a stiff back.
I see.
It's just a stiff back. So they pulled him out of there because they're like, we don't want you to adjust your delivery and mess up something with your arm. So it was bad news. But of all the different bad news of last night's game, that was the best resolution because you know what? Like a back can feel better in 3 days. When you hurt your arm, it sometimes takes 8 months to feel better.
So the Send Segura campaign is a success?
Yeah, a rousing success. How many votes did you vote, Dave?
Where do you get the ballots?
Oh, come on. It's online. There's a code.
Oh, Colleen. I was waiting for him to mail it to me.
Colleen, or did you rely on journalism objectivity and didn't vote?
Objectivity.
Oh!
But also skepticism. I wanted to know if this was a bunch of drummed up drama and that Segura was going to go all along and this was a marketing ploy.
That was true. There was part of me that was proud of that, Colleen. I was like, Colleen is gaining a cynicism about professional sports that's very warranted. And then there was part of me that was like, oh, Colleen is the consummate cheerleader. Why would she be finding flaws or potential warts in that? it was 13.6 million votes that he got. They also, did you see the t-shirts they had? It was hashtag Send Segura in his little smiling face.
Yeah.
Wyman asked for one from the general manager yesterday. And then after he asked, I promptly informed the general manager that, well, Dave didn't vote. He didn't cast any votes. I snitched on him. I was a terrible teammate.
There was a big old festival at Safeco, too. Did I catch that on Twitter?
Yeah.
I mean, they made a big to-do. That's why I'm thinking, are they drumming up support?
They definitely did. The team did. But it was great because it actually found traction. And we've wondered for a long time, like, when are the Mariners going to have the momentum? They've got the momentum right now.
Yeah.
People are interested and involved. And you had Felix fishing people off of First Avenue South to come on in and vote
at
Safeco Field.
So it wasn't a guarantee all along Segura was going to go. The votes did matter.
Yes, they did.
Okay, good.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think as long as the Russians weren't behind it, then everything is fine.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Earl Thomas and Instagram. Well, actually, you two can talk about that.
Yes, it's right in my alley.
I have never been on Instagram.
Drama.
Yeah.
So tell us about it.
So Earl made a strange post. It was something like God's plan. Then there was a football. Then there was a lion. And then there was a hashtag long body, which I'd never heard before.
So this was an emoji rebus post?
Yes. And then there was a smiley face with stars for eyes. So decoding all of that, I was like, it appears that Earl is happy this morning. That was my detective work. And then somebody said, Earl, when are you going to come to America's team, which is the nickname for the Dallas Cowboys? And Earl responded with, America's team, straight truth. And I looked at it and I was like, well, Earl grew up a Cowboys fan. In fact, one of my favorite moments was when I asked Earl, because Earl, where he grew up in Orange, Texas, which is southeast Texas, extreme southeast Texas, is closer to New Orleans than it is to Dallas. I was like, so did you grow up a Saints fan? He's like, no, man, I'm from Texas. It was very, very adamant.
Right line between the two.
He was a Cowboys fan.
And he also went into the Cowboys locker room, you may remember.
I remember that.
This is all sort of a storyline.
And that's the part of it where if you could say, like, oh, it's just a harmless little internet comment about his childhood favorite team. Yeah. You're like, no, he lost that plausible deniability last Christmas when he went into the locker room and everybody was like, what are you doing? So he knows what he's doing. This is a little bit of agitation or daydreaming or trying to add a little more angst to the situation because he'd like to go to Dallas.
But do you think he could?
No, because I don't think that the Seahawks, the Cowboys are willing to trade what the Seahawks want in order to acquire him. Okay. He could be there a year from now.
So is this part of the campaign for a contract extension?
Yes.
Which you say is not going to happen either?
I do not believe the Seahawks are going to extend his contract. He wants a new contract. He says he won't show up without a contract. He would like to be, if the Seahawks aren't going to give it to him, he would like to be traded to a team that will give him a new contract. And I don't think the Seahawks are going to give it to him. And I think they're going to call his bluff and see if he shows up.
When would that be?
2 weeks from now. 2 weeks from yesterday is when training camp starts.
So now the way you laid that out, so he could end up without a team at all.
If he chooses not to play, he wouldn't play. But that would be his choice. He's got an active contract for 2018. He's going to get paid $10 million, and he'll miss $500,000 for every game he sits out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of money to risk and put on the line for that. But if he is adamant about not playing without a new contract, I think it's possible he won't play. Now, he would miss six games and then report for a simple reason of you have to be there for the final 10 games for your contract to expire. Like, he wouldn't miss the whole season because then you would just be back in the same situation he was.
So would they play him?
I don't know. Once he showed up, probably depends on how they're doing. He's a really good football player. I can't imagine you wouldn't play Earl Thomas.
Are you able to put that kind of stuff behind you and perform on the field?
Sometimes.
It just seems that this is. I haven't seen a player go this far before.
Cam did. You remember Cam didn't show up for a couple games in 2015.
Training camp in a couple games.
It wrecked the season. They were terrible to start, and they spent the whole year digging out of that hole. But it's done. Walter Jones used to never come to training camp because of a contract thing. And he would show up and play the first game and be just fine, even without any practice, which made you wonder just how darn good he was
if he didn't even need practice.
I think most other players look at it as, hey, it's your business. You handle it. I'm not going to judge what you decide to do. It hurts the rest of the team. He's one of their best players, and he doesn't show up there. I don't think most players get resentful. But when Cam held out, there were some guys that didn't like that, that felt that, hey, he put himself above the team, and he hurt all of us.
Well, 2 weeks, we'll tell the tale, huh?
It will. We'll see if he's there and then see when he shows up if he's not.
Sports Insider Danny O'Neill. Thank you, Danny.
Have a great weekend.
You too. Sponsored by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Affordable housing and the homelessness crisis. So many perspectives. We know the NIMBY perspective, right? We're on board with any solution so long as my property taxes don't go up and nothing changes in my single-family home neighborhood. Then there's the YIMBY perspective. Yes, in my backyard. Build it up, build it out, tiny homes, backyard cottages, anything we can do to rezone the city for housing of all types will bring costs down for everyone. But what we don't often hear are advocates for neighborhoods in places like Rainier, the Rainier Valley in South Seattle, historically black and brown areas of Seattle that have been hit with gentrification and which have seen the condos explode around them and neighbors displaced. Daeshik Kim Hawkins is a journalist, activist, advocate for the homeless, and author of a feature in this month's issue of The Atlantic titled An App for Ejecting the Homeless, which is about Seattle's Find It, Fix It app. You know what the Find It Fix It app is. It's designed to report potholes and cracks on the sidewalk, but people are using it in neighborhoods to report homeless camping, and he's frustrated.
Well, we need to acknowledge that our city does not want to invest, at least currently, in things like affordable housing. And right now, there's a lot of houseless folks on the street waiting for resources. Maybe another 200 shelter beds are proposed by our current mayor. And that's not really doing
it. But there are middle-class people who have good jobs who can't afford to live in Seattle, so they move out into the suburbs. So how do you expect people who've got no money to live in Seattle?
The problem is getting worse. The problem is getting worse, and a lot of these residents within the city are faced with this reality that their home is no longer their home. And so, yeah, a lot of them are moving further south and south, I being one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of people ask me, what's in it for me? Why do I keep continuing to care about issues like this? I was just in court 6 months ago fighting my own landlord after he raised the rent, and I said, I can't do this anymore. I'm not going to renew my lease. He tried to drop a $10,000 charge on myself. So I'm representing myself, and if I lost that case, I find myself in similar situations too. So a lot of us fighting for this issue aren't just angry socialists on the left yelling because for the sake of it. A lot of we're facing the same epidemic in front of our own faces.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you endorse, for example, upzoning neighborhoods so that private developers can build more housing? Because nothing lowers housing prices like a glut of housing.
I think we need to be looking at different districts and seeing finding out solutions per neighborhood that we're living in. I, for one, support proposing a moratorium on development on the South End specifically.
A moratorium on development?
On the South End specifically.
Why?
Well, because there's no accountability there right now.
What does that mean?
You see these developments popping up on the South End over and over again.
That's good.
Well, that's good unless there's not a cap on, or at least a set number on how much affordable housing is supposed to be built.
A cap? If you put a cap on housing, housing's going to get more expensive. I hear people say two things that are in complete conflict. Let's create affordable housing, but let's not gentrify the neighborhood. That doesn't make any sense.
You can't have the same policies up in the North End where a lot of these single family homeowners are fighting against development.
Mm-hmm.
While those same resources and ability to rally behind council members and fighting for what is happening on the South End, there are two separate different issues happening at the mm-hmm. same time.
Well, the people on the North End who are fighting development are also arguing against their cause. I mean, there are a lot of liberals who live up there who want lower housing prices, but they don't want to upzone single family homes. That's going to have to change. But the same's true on the South End. You're not going to see cheap, low-income housing being built on the North End. That's not why people move there. But you probably will see some built on the South End. What's wrong with that?
So why can't those types of homes be built on the North End is my question.
Because for some reason, people want to be sorted by income. Didn't used to be the case, but these days it is.
So modern-day segregation.
Yeah, absolutely. By income? Yeah.
So, and that's exactly what I'm saying. Why does the South End have to take all that density? And without any accountability to see
what's wrong with the density? I don't understand what you find.
I'm not anti-density. I'm saying it is not equitable right now, the type of development that's happening around our city. The South End is suffering. Those families are being pushed out at a way rapid rate versus the North End. And right now, there's no level of accountability. We have a blanket statement policy.
Well, they're being, people being pushed out all over if they can't afford the housing. But what I'm saying is if you don't allow more housing to be built, you're not going to solve the problem. I think what you're finding is that people who would normally be your allies, liberal Seattleites, have had it up to here with taxes.
Yeah, property taxes are through
the roof. So you're not going to get any more money from the city to build housing. So where's it going to come from? It's going to come from small developers or medium developers who knock down old housing on the south side of town and put up apartments.
Hey, listen, the Gun Alliance just passed their policy. They just got the 375,000 signatures within the 3 weeks, and I promise this is relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they broke a record. 375,000 signatures in 3 weeks to pass gun reform,
mm-hmm.
or at least definitely a big step towards gun reform in Washington State.
Yes.
What people aren't talking about is that they're able to raise $4.2 million within that time span. How are they doing that? People like Paul Allen donated $1.25 million of his own money. Nick Hanauer matched that donation.
Right.
And it proves if billionaires can buy policy change, they can create change using their money. I agree with people who are saying $40 million wasn't a lot, and it wasn't going to make a huge dent in the affordable housing crisis that we have with the head tax that was shot down. But the fact is that was a principal battle. that was saying to these billionaires, to these upper 1% of Seattleites, saying, we are going to hold you accountable and we need you to create change with the resources you're taking out from the community. And right now, at least from me and my perspective as an organizer, we're unwilling to hold our billionaires accountable in that way.
Daeshik Kim Hawkins. We have much more to talk about. So this is the problem. If you want to get housing prices under control, there's got to be more housing. You can legislate all you want, but you can't force people to give away housing. And the city obviously can't raise enough tax money to house all the people who need it. What was the number? Like 14,000 new units you need? Something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's a big one.
It's huge. So I'm talking with Daeshik Kim Hawkins, who writes for The Atlantic and for The Stranger and for other publications, and is also an activist. I mean, he has protested some of the removals in the Ravenna neighborhood. And so I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with the idea of building more housing in South Seattle, which, yes, means demolishing some of the cheaper housing units, but replacing them with a lot more housing and let developers create a glut, because when there's a glut of housing, prices go down.
I'm all about building affordable housing. We need to be building those now. The moratorium, I'm not supporting a moratorium on development across the city. There are certain pockets of Seattle that have suffered through the massive development happening around our city and our county. And that pocket of neighborhoods, that pocket of communities needs a break from that. There's too much. You see Beacon Hill right now, that neighborhood is completely changed.
Yeah.
You know, and how much, what percent
every place
of,
around here has changed.
Well, what percent of those neighborhoods, historically black and brown communities,
that's the cheapest property.
And what percentage of those housing being built at a rapid rate, as you're suggesting, is affordable?
Yeah,
we eventually will hit a market crash where developers are going to be like, we can't rent out these properties. Yeah, sure, we'll get there. But my question is, what do we do until that point? What do we do until that happens?
I would love to see the city build piles of affordable housing, but you look at the units they build, you see how expensive they are? They spend $500,000 per unit. That's not going to house a lot of people.
To the city's credit, they've been trying to build some tiny home villages, one down in the Central District, and you saw how that town hall went.
Yeah.
Not good.
No.
Not good. So when we try to put out solutions, what do we got? We're met. And a lot of reasons why I wrote that article in The Atlantic is to expose that, yes, trust me, I'm the first person to be at City Hall to give public comment, to protest, whatever, okay? But we also must recognize it is the culture that we've built in this city, that this xenophobic mentality saying, nah, we don't want anything other than what we're comfortable with. We need to bring that to light. In an era of viral videos of seeing white neighbors calling the cops on mundane activities, we're seeing that same type of culture and dynamic happening with our houses folks here.
Yeah, but mundane activities sometimes involves human waste. Nobody is going to say, okay, for the sake of solving homelessness, we'll let people defecate in our yards. That's not going to happen ever. No, I mean, even people who sympathize with you are not going to live under those circumstances.
I mean, I'd be enlightened to see the number of complaints within the Find It, Fix It app and see what's broken down to actually people reporting people pooping on people's yards.
Yeah.
It's you see these complaints. Literally, if you see somebody that you do not recognize, usually back in black or brown in your neighborhood, you're going to report them.
Yeah, that's probably what it's come to. That's too bad, especially in a city like this where you wouldn't expect it to happen. But that's because nobody wants to take the long-term approach and do what needs to be done.
So we don't want to tax our big businesses. You know, we don't want to stop development. We don't want to put a mandatory amount of affordable housing within these policies. So what do we got?
Well, the status quo, I agree with the things you've said, except you think we should stop development. And that's what I think your big mistake is.
I said we should have a moratorium on specific neighborhoods who have suffered the impact of massive density without any accountability.
Yeah, but that's a moratorium on the neighborhoods where the property is cheapest and where developers want to develop. And so that brings you to an impasse. It means that we're just going to be in the same cycle probably forever.
Well, my question is,
what city is doing it right? Let me ask you that.
Well, what neighborhood do you live in?
Mercer Island.
Okay, so
I'm irrelevant to this.
Okay. Well, my question is for those neighborhoods like Ballard, for Fremont, yeah, for Wallingford, what's it going to take to convince them that maybe some zoning policies need to change?
I think they're on the verge of doing that. I mean, I'm seeing people. I had a person in here the other day who lives in one of those neighborhoods, and she says, yes, I would like to see more apartments built there. But what I'm saying to you is that the apartments you're going to see in those North Seattle areas are not going to be the kind of affordable apartments you're looking for because the property is just too expensive. You can't build affordable housing on multi-million dollar property. You can build it in the South End where property's cheap, but that's exactly where you don't want it to go. So that's why the impasse exists.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I look at these neighbors on the North End, and when I'm at these a lot of these encampments that I'm protesting at or helping out unsheltered folks at, they're spread out across the city, and the animosity in different neighborhoods is very different.
Yeah.
You know, and you're right, the property is more expensive.
Well, actually, there's a solution in your own article. You point out that at one point there's a the cops are called to roust a couple of homeless guys, and it turns out they had permission to camp on this person's sidewalk, right?
You're talking about the one at Real Change?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for people who want to be accommodating, they are free to invite homeless people to camp on their property or in their backyards up in Magnolia or anywhere they want. Let's solve it that way. Why we're building affordable housing in the South End?
I'm telling you right now, I think we both can agree on this. Like, this epidemic is getting to a point where the amount of shelter that we have available, the amount of affordable housing, and the amount that the houses folks are multiplying in our city, we're reaching a point where I'm really concerned. I'm honestly really concerned of the safety of all residents. You know, it's my neighbor, their house got vandalized the other day, and I don't know what to tell them. You know, they're asking me like, hey, like, I know you're an advocate for these houses folks, but like, what do I do in this situation? And it's real. You know, it's real.
Because, I know it is.
And I, to be honest, I don't know what to tell them because I can humanize the situation and look at them and being like, yeah, this is a really unsafe situation. And it is. And I don't want to take away anything from that. But at the same time, we reached a point where the city has, at least in my opinion, shown its true color, saying which constituents that they're going to listen to the most. Which corporations are going to have their ear versus the regular people. And, you know, we're coming to a situation where when push comes to shove, I wouldn't be surprised even if the unsheltered folks start to organize.
Oh, and that'll be the end of it. Then the police will just crack down and kick them out. That's what'll happen. The rich people will not tolerate that for half a second. That'll be the end of it. Then your movement's lost forever. I think once you see that, that then would prove basically the charge that they're all criminals.
I mean, we're at a class war.
Yeah.
You know, we're at a real class war. And in a lot of ways, a situation like that, we're not very far away from. But we're seeing increments of that happening every day and a lot of fear mongering happening at the same time. And when you mix all of that up together, we live in a very unsettled time. And, you know, I wrote that article also really admitting that a lot of us are running out of answers too. You know, we've tried different things. You know, we've tried to form policies around taxing big businesses. We tried to force developers to put a higher percentage of mandatory housing. You saw a lot of that happening through Nikita Oliver's campaign. But all of that, you know, got lost. All of that has either been debunked, watered down, or really just taken off the table as a whole. And I'm telling you right now, as an organizer for affordable housing, as an organizer for the lower working class, we're running out of solutions. We're not sure what to do. And we know that now how important it is to have six council members who are going to fight for your issues. Because at the end of the day, without that, our mayor is going to end up making that decision for herself.
Daishik Kim Hawkins, you can find his latest feature in the current issue of The Atlantic, headlined An App for Ejecting the Homeless. And our entire interview is on the Ross File podcast at MyNorthwest.com.